This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Rest is Entertainment Questions version of the show.
That's getting snappier every week.
Yeah. Sorry, it's just, why am I so bad at it, Richard?
No, you're not. You're terrific at it.
Thank you.
It's because it shows, it's kind of that non-slickness. Actually, in a weird way, it's very slick.
As you always remind me, it is also an answers edition of the show.
Yes, question and answers. But yeah, that is authenticity is what people like.
Isn't it now? In which case, in the spirit of being completely authentic, I have got something wrong, obviously. We talked about Category 1 deaths on on this.
If you didn't listen, this is going to sound quite odd. Catch up now.
Yeah, we did talk about Category 1 deaths on the questions edition last week.
Questions and answers edition.
Which is the members of the royal family that the BBC will interrupt all news programming for, and it's a matter of protocol. And I said that it was the King, Camilla, Prince William, and Prince George. In fact, because Prince George is so young, he has not been made a Category 1. But Kate has recently been upgraded to a Category 1 death, not to do with the health scare. I should be very clear about that. So that now the Category 1 death category is Charles, Camilla, William, and Kate. And those are the people for whom all programming is automatically interrupted. Having said that, as we discussed, it would be interrupted for a lot of different people as well in the event of it. And that's an editorial decision made by the editor-in-chief, who is Tim Davey, as well as being the director general.
Here's a question from Oliver Marks. You've mentioned on the pod before that those wanting to write a novel should be reading lots of books. Is it the same with budding script writers? Should they read scripts, or can you get enough from just being an avid viewer?
Yes. First of all, you can find lots of scripts published, and there's some of the great, I mean, Faber recently brought out all the Succession scripts. And so those are really worth looking at. But having said all that, I would say watching is by far the best for the rhythms of speech. And when I first started writing scripts, I found that if you're writing Final Draft, which is the sort of software that everybody uses, my characters would be saying four or five lines to each other. Now, come on, okay? Any script that most people are involved with now, you really got to earn your four or five lines of Final Draft. It should be one or two lines.
Do you mean in the Final Draft,
in the center of the page, so it's not even a full two lines of what you in a Word document or anything like that. And when you're getting notes off someone like Armando Iannucci and you're doing a script, I was talking to Ian Martin, who was... began as the swearing consultant on the...
He's a very lovely man as well.
He's the most wonderful person. And I wrote a script with him on a series of Avenue 5, and it was just absolutely... He is a delight. But he will rightly say that all of Armando's notes essentially boil down to shorter, funnier. And actually, quite often, it will just say shorter, comma, funnier in the margin in blue. So in the sense that looking at a published script is quite helpful, you actually see, gosh, these lines really are quite short, and you learn not to waste words. And actually, as in Richard and I, we talked about this on the podcast before, learning not to waste words in any form of writing is the best thing you can do. Writing short first and becoming longer is always the best thing you can do.
But there's a temptation, isn't there? You know, you look at Aaron Sorkin or Jesse Armstrong and you remember some big long speech, some big grandstanding speech that someone did, and to write like that. And actually, both of them use those things very, very sparingly.
Yeah, you look at that speech in something like A Few Good Men, the famous sort of Jack Nicholson speech, you see how rat-a-tat the scene leading up to that is, with Tom Cruise questioning him, and, you know, and it's really, there's a lot of half lines in there. And then suddenly this kind of release comes. But in general, so published scripts are very useful for things like that. But in general, I would always say that watching and listening to people on the bus or anywhere, wherever it is, for the rhythms of speech is better.
I can't do screenwriting. And I've tried.
I find it
very difficult. I find it too fiddly, the business of the thing, having to put people's names and then sort of say interior something day. I just want to get on with, you know, writing what people are thinking and saying, you know. I've tried, and I can exclusively reveal I can't do it. I'm very bad at it. It's like the Thursday Murder Club movie. There's no way I would have written it, not just because of, you know, time and stuff like that. I just it's not my speciality. So I think for some people who've tried to do novels and it's not for them, screenwriting might be for them. And people who've tried to do screenwriting that's not for them do novels,
yeah,
because they're completely different forms of writing. They feel like they're the same form of writing, but I think they're entirely different. But you can get, if you write plays, just there are so many brilliant things available now. There's lots of free resources online as well. Just all the screenplays to some of the greatest movies ever made, the greatest TV shows. So yeah, just look at them. And sometimes it's worth looking at them whilst watching the thing,
yeah,
the scripts are, because you see little changes and little notes and how, you know, little bits of stage direction are interpreted. And it just gets you into the rhythm of how these things are done. So I would say 100%, if you want to screenwrite, read screenplays and watch things and maybe do both at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good primer. Richard, here's one for you from Aid Bond. When contestants are eliminated from a game show, do they wait in the green room for the rest of the contestants to join them, or are they in the next taxi out of town?
I love the way we apportion questions with each other. You've got I want to talk about writing. It's incredibly important about how all the great works of entertainment have been created, and I do contestants waiting around in green rooms. I think it's good. Yes, it's, well, two different answers, really. Lots of shows like Pointless, you're on the next show anyway, so you go back to your dressing room, yep, and get your next clothes on. By and large, if that's you off the show, you can go. Occasionally, you'll do a show where you do pickups at the end, in which case you have to stick around. Yep. I think 15 to 1 does that, though, because there's so many different camera shots in that, they'd have to pick up lots at the end. So you have to just essentially go into your dressing room and wait. And you can't even watch the show because the ring main is in a TV studio. All the monitors can show you what's happening in the studio. It's called the ring main. And by and large, you switch that off anywhere contestants might be because you don't want them to see rehearsals before the show, yep, or you don't want to give anything away. So you can't even watch the TV.
You can just stew in your own juice about your wrong answers.
Yeah, exactly. And think, I won't even have to do a pickup probably. And your pickup will always be the answer you got wrong as well. You'd be like, oh, you didn't get me getting that wrong, so now I have to do it again. I have to act and say, I'm going to say Anne of Cleves. No, that's wrong. And you've had to wait 4 hours to do that. But on a lot of celebrity shows, you get to go straight home because, you know, celebs won't stick around. We had lovely Kate Thornton on House of Games last week that we were filming, and she said that she had to get herself knocked out by round two of The Weakest Link because she had a taxi waiting because she has somewhere to be. And she said, I couldn't have gone beyond round two. So I think you see that on Weakest Link a lot, people taking a dive and people very happily sort of, because you get paid the same money if you get knocked out early or late. So off they pop. But yeah, by and large, you can go home. But yeah, certain shows you'd have to stick around because, you know, you have to go back to your podium and, you know, relive your humiliation because the cameras didn't pan to you quite quickly enough. And the green rooms in TV shows is a whole other thing. If anyone wants questions about what's in a green room on a TV show and different dressing rooms in different studios.
Fair to say, it varies in my experience.
Oh, I mean, it really varies. And also, listen, I don't want to go, but the amount of how early you have to get called to a TV studio sometimes.
Oh,
I just remember
God.
In COVID when, because by and large, they call you somewhere 2 hours. And even though I'm a producer, sometimes I forget and I turn up when they say, and in COVID, you would be in a tiny dressing room that no one was allowed to come into. You weren't allowed to go mix with anybody. And obviously, there weren't allowed to be any snacks and people weren't allowed to bring you anything. So you'd be sitting, you know, in a cell for 2 hours. Essentially, I mean, that's really niche. That was TV during COVID, and that's, you know, I suffered.
Well, also, you met your wife, so
yeah,
swings and roundabouts.
So come on, swings and roundabouts, exactly. Here's a question from Daniel Barnes, and it probably touches on something that's been in the news recently as well, but here's the question he's asking. Daniel says, when in TV and movies a character has a gun trained on them, is it just a bunch of crew with laser pointers, or do they add it with VFX?
Okay, it depends on the camera setup. They might, depending on whose coverage, as in every time a scene is filmed, you'll have lots and lots of different camera setups to get every single piece of that scene. So there may be a part where someone is using a laser pointer. But in general, the weapons that come onto set are bought by an armourer. This has been in the news for various reasons recently, and we'll talk about that in a second. In old Hollywood, they would use live rounds all the time. It was obviously a complete sort of Wild West. But now you would have weapons with a laser sight on it, and the actor would be pointing them. But that armourer who comes onto a set, I've worked on a couple of shows that there's been an armourer, and they are the most obsessively careful people you can possibly imagine. And for one of them, there wasn't even a gun. It was a sort of form of crossbow. But they are so careful in general. And they have to be, and they check everything a million times. And you sometimes think, why are we going over this, like, for a makeshift crossbow that doesn't even work? Why are we going over all these ridiculous protocols? Well, you'll all have seen the story that happened with Alec Baldwin on this filming, this sort of, again, a Wild West film called Rust, where there was an armourer on set. She is now going to prison for 18 months. I mean, quite rightly. The weapon wasn't checked. Alec Baldwin discharged it in a scene, killed the director of photography, injured the director. One of the things I found fascinating about the story is that when I first heard about it, I was like, how absolutely dreadful. This is the job of the armourer. And people who've worked on proper sets that are well run with an armourer, nothing like that could possibly have happened. There were live rounds mixed in with the blanks. I mean, this is absolute madness. But what I think is quite weird and interesting is you just don't see anyone in Hollywood defending Alec Baldwin over this, which I think is unusual or eye-catching in some way. And it may be because Alec Baldwin's quite annoying and people find him annoying in some way or another. But also I think that there's a perception that that movie is only happening because none of us will ever go to see the movies and see Rust. It's probably being made for TV.
Yeah, but they're back on... They're back on set making it.
But none of us would ever go, I mean, now perhaps people will in some ghoulish way go and look. But you would see it maybe on a streaming service, whatever. But that movie is only happening because of Alec Baldwin. He has got a massive executive producer fee. He's got a massive... And sometimes you find that in order to get a film greenlit, you need, in this case, Alec Baldwin. Otherwise, nobody else is there. Yeah. So huge amounts of money are siphoned from all the budget, really, towards a big EP fee, as well as a stars fee. He's starring it as well, but he's an executive producer too. Clearly, on some of these sets, and people in the industry will talk to you about this and will say, they're cutting corners because how you've got such a young armourer who doesn't know what you're doing in a film that is a Western, by the way.
Yeah, so lots of guns.
Weapons is a significant part of it. But pure speculation, but I'm wondering whether there's a lack of defence for him from the wider entertainment community because people feel that at some level, he as a producer and as a producer who was being paid a big fee is responsible for the standards on the wider set. And if it's solely a vanity credit, then maybe stop taking the vanity credits and so much money in order that sets can be run properly. That is speculation. I don't know. But I think it's very, very significant, the lack of public support he's had.
And it's fascinating that thing of, as you say, you know, you've got a crossbow and it doesn't even work. Yeah. And so why are you taking all those steps? And the reason you're taking all those steps is just to instill in every single person, this is what we always do, whatever happens. Because if you start kind of taking shortcuts on that, then you'll take shortcuts on the next step up and the next step up. And that's why so many jobs involve absolutely going through the same motions every single time. It's like being a pilot or something. Yeah. You have to do, even though you know what you're doing, you have to check things off a list every single time, just because when you're doing a job where safety is paramount, pilot, armourer, then you just need to make sure that the processes are in place every single time.
Absolutely. And the fact that they've gone back to continue with it is truly tells you everything about the type of industry and the money and how they look at it.
Yeah. I mean, Daniel Barnes, I know that's not what you asked, but I hope it's...
It's a bit of a tangent there.
Yeah. I hope you found it helpful.
In-flight entertainment, Richard. Darren Hinchy asks, my question's about movies and TV shows that can be watched on airplanes. Who chooses what will be shown? Is there good money selling a movie or TV show to an airline? Are TV shows like Hijack banned from being shown?
Do you know what? I was on a plane recently and someone was watching Hijack on their iPad, right in front, just sort of in my eye line. Oh. So, you know, yes, they are banned from being shown, or certainly they're not encouraged to be shown anything with their air crashes. So by and large, I mean, we all know what those entertainment systems are. They're sort of a mix of TV shows and films, and, you know, it's always like they've got Curb Your Enthusiasm, but one episode, and the Big Bang Theory, they've got 40 episodes, and, you know, Tulsa Kings, they've got episode 2 of season 1 and episode 5 of season 2. But there is a sort of method behind the madness by and large. There's a sort of very simple answer. By and large, it's for an hour of content, be that film, TV, documentary, whatever, you would get $1,300 per hour if you're the producer. So if you're the distributor who's selling that onto the airlines, you would get $1,300 an hour for your content, which doesn't sound an awful lot, but two things make it slightly more lucrative. One, it's always non-exclusive. So you're getting $1,300 an hour from British Airways, but you can sell the same content to Virgin and Delta. Yep. You can set it to 40 airlines if you want the exact same thing. So suddenly you're getting, you know, £45,000 an hour. And secondly, it's only for 3 months, so they've got a three-month license on it. And in the world where, I mean, if you're making a big Marvel film, it's not making a huge amount of difference to your bottom line, but you do an overall deal in that situation if you're a studio. But if you are, you know, a documentary maker, or you have a sort of smaller British sitcom, and we've talked before about how everything is deficit funded now, which is channels can't afford everything. If you're suddenly getting, you know, another $40,000 an hour for your product, and you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, literally it's just money in your back pocket.
And it's marketing
as well. Then it can be incredibly useful. So it kind of works for the airlines because they're not paying a huge amount per hour for what they're putting on. It works for producers because they can be on 40, 50 different airlines around the world. And it's money that, you know, they haven't put in the budget and they're not expecting. Kind of works for everybody. But, you know, in these days of everyone bringing their own tablets and things onto planes, I'm not entirely sure how long that industry has left. But there's certain films that work beautifully on planes. I watched an amazing film called Swing Vote with Kevin Costner.
I've watched that on a plane.
Yeah, there you
go. It's an absolute classic.
You know, and it just, you think,
the
great.
Entire US election comes down to one vote.
Kevin
and
Costner.
It's Kevin Costner's.
Yeah, it's as good as it sounds. But I imagine if I saw that at the cinema, I'd walk out.
Oh, yeah. I can't envisage myself buying a ticket at the window.
But this also, good luck walking out when you're on a plane. I mean, that's, you'd really have to hate a film. I'm going to say there's one film I saw in the cinema that genuinely, if I was watching on a plane, I would open the emergency exit and throw myself out.
Which one was it, please?
I cannot begin to tell you the mail we would get.
Really?
If I said what that film was.
Was it by Guy Ritchie?
Wow.
Shall we go to a break now?
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm going straight into a question about...
That's a good idea.
...agents. But
don't you think on the question and answer, you know?
Yeah. Alistair Otto would like to know, with a 35-year passion for football, I think I possess a good understanding of agents and their impacts on maximising players' potential and earnings after following this side of the game in the media. Thank you. Good use of euphemisms, Alistair.
All right, the rest is football.
Yeah. But he's curious about the entertainment industry. How influential are agents? Is having a great agent more crucial than having a good one? Or does an individual's success ultimately hinge on talent alone in this field?
It is fairly crucial, I would say, to have a great agent. There,
I like the fact that you do not have a TV agent, though, Richard.
I don't have an agent. I think I'm the last remaining
holdout. You've got a literary agent, but not a TV agent.
Well, because I don't understand the business of books, where I do understand the business of TV. So people will send me a contract, and you go, that doesn't look exactly right to me. Certainly in the world of comedy and entertainment, the big agencies have a real stranglehold on who's on television. And that's not quite as incestuous as it sounds, because actually people gravitate towards those agents anyway. So by and large, they tend to get the kind of big names coming to them. So in comedy, there's Off the Curb, which is huge. A guy is no longer with us, Addison Creswell, who for years and years looked after Jonathan Ross and Michael McIntyre and loads of Lee Evans, loads and loads of big names. There's Hannah Chambers, who looks after Jimmy Carr and Joe Lycett and lots of other people. So there are a few big names out there. And if you are with one of them, it is a huge advantage. Firstly, it's a huge advantage when you start out because, you know, Addison would say, well, of course you can have Jonathan, but if you have Jonathan, you have to take client X, who he's just got on his books, and Hannah would do the same. And, you know, not always officially, they're not kind of, but they're just saying, I would love it. I've got this new client. I'd love it if you'd look at them. And you know that if you do that, you have access to the bigger clients as well. Avalon, who's another of the big agents, would do exactly the same. They'd often package up whole TV shows which are just their clients. And certainly if you wanted to book their client on a show that, because they were a production company as well, Avalon. So if you wanted to book their client on a show that was not made by them, it would get tricky sometimes. And by the way, that's their business. They're perfectly allowed to do it. I think sometimes it does their clients a disservice because...
Well, they're the most loved in the business.
Is being loved all there is?
I will say something in terms of writing agents, which is, I've spoken to quite a few comedy writers about this, and maybe some of them are all with big people now, but I remember speaking to someone who's very, very successful, saying that when he was younger in his career, he signed with one of the big agencies. I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was UTA or something like that. And he thought, I've arrived.
Yeah.
And actually, he ended up going to someone smaller because he felt that they had so many big clients that kind of those clients got lots of the jobs. And you sort of feel like, oh, I'm represented by Ari Emanuel, or I'm represented by, you know, or CAA or something like that. And there's some sort of big sort of status brand thing about the agency. But actually, there are so many brilliant, younger, much hungrier agents who really are thinking about your career and building you as maybe as a writer and making sure that you don't have to do the things you don't want to do and really looking after you. So a big shout out to the smaller agencies and the smaller agents as well, who often people think they get a much better sort of tailor-made service rather than being with these kind of big behemoths.
100%. I say if you're, you know, an option you can take, if you've just had a great Edinburgh and people love your comedy and you're working out who to go with, you could either be a smaller cog in a bigger wheel, but there is something to be said to being a bigger cog in a smaller wheel and someone really building your career. So, you know, Avalon will put on live shows as well and will take people up to Edinburgh and will build people's profile and all that kind of stuff. But there are downsides to being part of that machine. Whereas if you've got a slightly more personalised, smaller agent whom you're their most important client, your emails are probably answered a little bit quicker. But my goodness, is it three or four agencies which have a real stranglehold, especially on television comedy, I would say, and television entertainment.
And in movies as well. I mean, if you look at the big ones and, you know, you look at CAA or Endeavour, what I would say about those is that even the really big agents there, and I absolutely love reading about agents and agenting. It's a real sort of, there's two great books on agents. The one about CAA, which is...
and CAA stands for...
Creative Artists Agency.
Which is one of the big...
It was started by Michael Ovitz and about four others in the 80s, and it became, or was it the late 70s? I can't even remember. It defines everything, and he ends up packaging shows and putting, as Richard has just described, when you're putting all of your stars into a show or a movie, you bring the director, you bring Scorsese, but these guys, someone like Michael Ovitz is such a monster, actually, but one of the great monsters of Hollywood, but sort of a fascinating figure. And he has written his own book, which I've also read, which is called Who is Michael Ovitz?
Oh, wow.
You should know, mate. But and it's
by Michael Ovitz.
Yes, by Michael Ovitz. But what those agents do is, it's really interesting. Things like Cape Fear was originally a script that Steven Spielberg had, And Martin Scorsese had the rights to Schindler's List. And it was Ovitz who finessed and said, I think actually you'd both be better off with these, and did the sort of switcheroo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but there's so many stories like that. There's stories of them ringing in, you know, there's stories of them ringing in bomb threats to stop planes taking off in order to sort of get there. I mean, the skullduggery is extraordinary. But equally, Ron Mayer, you know, who is Michael Ovitz's partner for a long time, will sit for 5 hours on the phone to Sylvester Stallone, who wants to talk in absolute depth about where his career is going. You know, and they built an incredible career for him.
Well, it's fascinating. There's less money in TV now. And so I was just thinking then that agents are a little bit gentler now, but I think that's because there's less money, so they have less room for manoeuvre. But Addison Creswell, for example, I mean, he was an unbelievable character. He's such an incredible wide boy. Absolutely, you know, loved his clients and everyone was incredibly loyal to him. But the deals he would make in the 90s when TV had a lot of money were huge. I mean, immense. I mean, the money that people were getting paid, TV presenters and comedians, for TV shows in the 90s and the noughties was absolutely phenomenal, and largely due to Addison, because he just kept raising the ceiling of what you get paid per show, to the extent that BBC started having to slightly match that as well, to the extent that even if you were with a smaller agent, you know, your fees would be going up as well. And he sort of bankrupted a lot of entertainment companies, Addison. And he wasn't doing it for that, but he struck such amazing deals that a lot of TV comedy became, you know, almost impossible to make because it became too expensive. And living through the sort of 10, 15 years afterwards, when you would say, you're actually going to have to take a pay cut now, and for like a series, it would be absolutely resisted. No one was going to take a pay cut. And then the agents, all the big agents, suddenly realizing they're not kidding anymore. The show's going to come off air if my presenter, who's currently being paid £50,000 an episode, they're going to have to be paid £30,000 an episode. Yeah. And I'm furious about it, but I guess that's the new economics. We had a presenter once on an ITV show, and this is not really an agent story, but he was on, I think, £20,000 a show for one of those big long-running shows, a show that was on like 200 episodes a year. So it's like, you know, kind of 4 million to do this. And they just commissioned another series of it, I think 100 episodes, something. He was due 2.5 million. And they took it off air about a week before they said, actually, we're not going to make it. And so the production company, it's a terrible thing for them, because it's a huge bit of business, and lots of people who were about to be employed for the next 6 months suddenly weren't employed. Contractually, they still had to pay the presenter. So he got £2.5 million for a series he never had to record. And that was TV back then.
That's agency. You know,
before I became a presenter, that's for sure. But it's really, really important which agent you're with.
And at the award ceremonies, you'll notice this. If you go to the award ceremonies at the after parties in America, like the Emmys or Oscars or whatever, almost the whole agency is there. And they're sort of forming a ring of steel around the big clients, so that no other agent is going up to them saying, oh, you didn't see that script. No, I heard they send it to Jennifer Lawrence, but you didn't see that. They didn't get you, your agent didn't get you that, or whatever it is.
So that
people, because people do change agencies. Dakota Johnson, she changed agencies in the week that the Madam Web trailer came out, perhaps rightly. But you know, people do change agencies, and then they're gone. They're lost to you as a money-making opportunity. So there is real defensiveness about your clients. Even if you don't think they're that great, you don't want anyone else to have them.
I've always made a point throughout my entire career, always, 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 whenever I'm with a piece of talent, someone like an on-screen presenter or comedian or something, I always tell them how their agents have dealt with me. Always. And if they've been rude, I always say, oh, you know, your agent was... Yeah. There was a friend of mine who was with an agent who was notoriously awful. I mean, just genuinely a bad human being. I said, you know that that's really, really represents you. Like every time someone talks to that person about you and they're genuinely rude, or, you know, put the phone down or shout, it reflects on you. And he left that agent very soon. But I'll always make sure, you always have to, if someone... Especially if they've gone, oh, you can't have him unless you take so-and-so, because that comedian doesn't know that.
No, they should know what's been done in their name.
So I always tell.
That's very good.
So for any agent who's ever done that to me, I've always told your client immediately afterwards.
Equally, sometimes agents will go out and say, particularly I've noticed on BBC salary stories, when the salary will come out and someone will say, this is really gross, why is my client only getting paid this? I remember someone, quite a high-profile news presenter, this happened with, and I remember thinking, I don't know, mate, but it's your fault, isn't it? Why is your client being paid that?
Yeah, because you're the agent.
I wouldn't announce it in a sort of, it's your fault, you've messed up, I hope she leaves you.
One of the lovely things on House of Games, because we have lots and lots of people on that, so we do deal with lots of smaller agents and people just starting in the business as well, and sometimes they'll come along. And I love that. I absolutely love it. And, you know, they couldn't be nicer.
And they'll often accompany the client. You're getting the real tailor-made service at that point.
Yeah, and you can tell they're friends, and you always sit down and have a laugh with them as well. That was a long answer to a short question. Actually, to be fair, it was quite a long question as well, because we had all the stuff about football. So, Alistair, listen.
Which we didn't even get on to.
I don't think that's our business, is it?
I don't know. It's all that's almost media.
That's one for the rest is money or the rest is football. I think we've got time for a short one. Though sometimes I ask a question that I think is going to be short and then we bang on for
really drag it out.
I think this is going to be short though. Okay. Certainly it's a short question. Joe Rose, it's even a short name. Joe Rose. Joe Rose says, why are green screens green?
Oh, very good. Okay. Green screens are also sometimes blue. There's also blue and green screen. Now, they use green mainly because it's the colour least present in skin tones. So it's least likely to kind of mess around with the people who are in front of it. Having said that, if you've got a bit of practical set at the front, which a lot of these things do have, or there's a bit of green in costumes, then you're going to want a blue screen. Funnily enough, the show I'm working on at the moment, even though it's a sort of behind the scenes on a superhero franchise, all our green screen stuff has been blue screen. Marvel, there's a brilliant picture that I really urge you to Google. If you Google James Gunn's brother, Rocket Raccoon, okay, obviously Bradley Cooper voices Rocket Raccoon, but James Gunn's brother is there in a little green onesie. I mean, it looks so poignant. I mean, I really have to say, interesting relative values that one would be. There's Dave Bautista, the big wrestler, petting him in a still. I strongly urge you to look at this picture. So that is...
Oh, let's get it. Neil, can you get that for us? Oh my God, that's haunting.
The expression is, what am I doing with my life?
That expression is, I am going to bring mum straight after this. Wow, you got to have a look at it. It looks so sad.
So it's not just screens that are green. Props, costumes, anything that's going to have to be taken out afterwards. A chroma key, they call it. Blue is better. It's easier to light blue. Green is the most reflective colour on the spectrum. So you've got to light it perfectly. Yeah, strangely. It's got the highest level of luminosity.
I'm going to take issue with that.
Yeah, just don't argue with me on it.
I think silver.
And so it's easier to light, and blue is easier sometimes to light. But
essentially, green is the thing that's least like skin tones.
Yes, but there's some really amazing footage now of green screen. Marvel, I think it's very odd that they've allowed people to see behind the scenes. So you just see these people making these incredibly soulless scenes that then become like some great big battle, which in my view are quite soulless as well. But
it's like my favourite bit of Planet Earth is always the 5 minutes at the end.
They show
how they shot the meerkats. Talking of shooting meerkats, I think we're done.
Yes, that's where we're off to.
Because we like to socialise after the podcast.
And
this is a fun thing. Rupert Murdoch sent us the invitation. He said, guys, we're on a meerkat hunt. Guy Ritchie's going to be there.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're not really hunting meerkats.
No. Yeah. And on that note.
See you next Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.